Anyway, so I'm going to talk about the binary neutron star merger, the first one that we saw back in 2017. Fun fact, this has been pretty much my entire postdoc career. When this thing was detected, I was in the shower, and the people who run the search pipeline texted me. They said, get on the phone now. I was one of the first people to actually see the raw data, including the big noise artifact on top of the Livingston data. I sent out the first GCN, and then my career since then has been dealing with the repercussions of that act. So, phone was next to the shower. And it turns out that I'm not the only person with such a story. Depending on which time zone you were in, you were either getting out of the shower or going into the shower when you got the phone call. But anyway, so I am here. I'm in 268 if people want to come find me, or you know, I'll just be around after the talk. But I'm going to talk about the matter effects, some work that I've been doing over the past few years. So first, a 60-second introduction to gravitational waves and the detectors. And I have a timer here, so I'm going to try to stick to 60 seconds. But the first thing is that we have detectors, and they're fixed to the Earth. So there's one in Hanford, Washington. There's one in Livingston, Louisiana. Those are the two US ones. Virgo is up here. I'm very proud of this picture. I show it because these little clock faces, the arms are actually the correct directions of the arms on the globe. So that's some number of hours I'll never get back. We're building one in India somewhere. I don't think they've broken ground, but I do think that they have purchased the land in Kagra in Japan, which is in Toyama, right here in the little crook, is coming online possibly as early as this year. So here are some nice pictures. All these trees are dead and gone now, and there used to be an alligator that lived here in Louisiana. I think he's gone as well. There are a persistent problem with tumbleweeds, I've been told, up here in the high deserts. And over here, I think this is actually the nuclear waste site. So we live in very interesting places, but they're in the middle of nowhere so that people don't mess up our measurements. And then quickly, an introduction to 0817. So we saw it in a bunch of different things, gamma rays, gravitational waves. It's both coincident in time and spatially coincident. So this green thing is what you get from gravitational waves. The little orange dot is what you actually see if you point telescopes. And then the broader things are what you got from the gamma ray bursts. So this all sort of makes a beautiful picture. And then this is a series of beautiful pictures. Down here on the bottom, this is the number of days since the thing happened, since coalescence hit us. And you can see this dot. This is, I believe it's from the dark energy camera in the I band. But you can see the transient is originally really bright, and then it decays over time. So this is the host galaxy, and then the actual kilonova in the I band. I stole this picture because it's cool, and you can see it actually happen. All right, so that's it. That's all we're going to talk about, detectors and the actual detection. I'm now going to talk about what I've been doing for the past two and a half years. The main things I'm going to focus on, as you probably gleaned from my abstract, are equation of state inference, in particular, an approach that I've developed with a guy who used to be here a lot, Phil Landry, using non-parametric methods based on Gaussian processes. And then we'll also talk about some non-linear tidal instabilities that we people have gone and looked for and what that would do to the waveform, and sort of give a summary of where we are with this matter effect in gravitational wave signals. So to begin with, if you want to figure out what neutron stars are made of, what the equation of state is, I claim that these are reasonable goals to have. So the first one is to use the knowledge that other people have. So theorists are really smart. You guys here, you know, you appear very smart. So I want to use your knowledge to make myself look better, and I want to do it in a self-consistent way. So the way I'm saying is I want to use arbitrary tabulated equation of state. Someone comes up with a theory, I need to be able to incorporate that into my analysis in a transparent way. So I can, you know, the types of things that I'm going to test are reflective of what people think actually physically happens in nature. So the way we do this is we use proposed equation of state to build the basis of our inference, and then expand upon it in the following ways. I also want to automatically incorporate certain things like causality and thermodynamic stability, because I believe that those are laws that equation of state should obey. And I also want to have huge amounts of model freedom. So really, what I'm going to work in is this auxiliary variable here, which I called phi, just because. But if we think about this as a function of the pressure, this auxiliary variable phi that we call, any curve that I draw here will give me a valid equation of state. So phi can span the entire real line, positive and negative. Any curve that I draw gives me a causal and thermodynamically stable equation of state. So what this means is that by drawing any curve in this space, I automatically satisfy these conclusions or these constraints. But it also means that I can literally draw any curve in this space, and it satisfies those constraints. So if I'm going to try to generate a bunch of different trial curves, I can use some sort of machine to do this, or I can, you know, hire a bunch of postdocs and pay them to just squiggle lines every single day. Some way I can just generate these curves in a completely arbitrary process. We don't actually use an arbitrary process. We try to put in very transparent priors, so some sort of degree of belief, like how quickly do these wiggles wiggle, and how big are they? So things like the length scale, which would this would be like ratios of pressures, or the amplitude of the fluctuations, how much freedom do we allow in the priors for the types of things that we're going to try there? And the reason we want to really have transparent things is, as we'll get into in some detail, the conclusions that one makes about the equation of state right now with the limited data we have can depend quite strongly on what you assume about the equation of state, so your prior assumptions. So because that is the case, we're sort of still prior dominated, not data dominated, you need to really understand what your prior beliefs are to make, you know, a sort of a interpretable statement about the equation of state. And there's some people in this room who have recently gotten a paper accepted that harps on these points too. So you guys can definitely chime in if I make a mistake. So anyway, this is what going to be determined by something that we call the covariance kernel in our Gaussian process, which sounds like I work in Silicon Valley. But let me just explain to you a little bit what Gaussian processes are. So let me see if I can turn up the lights here. OK, can people see this a little better? Yeah. All right. So a Gaussian process is a way to describe uncertainty in a function. And by a function, what I really mean is like a infinite dimensional space. So this function really is this phi of log p, or phi of x, is some infinite dimensional vector space. And I need to describe the types of behavior that I believe. And this is typically done in a Gaussian process if you consider like one point here and one point here. So let's say A and B. Then you'll have phi of A, phi of B. And you can pick any A or B. And for a Gaussian distribution, the two things you need to specify are what the means are, so the average value of this function at these points, and how they're correlated, what the covariance is. So really what we specify in a Gaussian process is exactly that mean, some average function that you're sort of going to wiggle around, and then how much it can wiggle. And the covariance is something like phi of A, phi of B. And this is typically taken to be some function of the absolute value of the difference between A and B. So the difference between these points. And then there are some parameters in here that tells you, you know, how this thing scales. So one common covariance kernel is something like just a Gaussian. So you put in a length scale that says how far away do you have to be before things become uncorrelated, like they can flap up and down independently, and also how big the overall flapping is. So what you would end up with, if you specify such a covariance kernel, is in addition to maybe a mean, which we'll say looks like this, you can just put it in whatever you want, you end up with uncertainty estimates that will tell you that, well, the functions like to wiggle sort of in this direction, and then maybe they'll go down like that. And this program, this algorithm, can generate as many curves as you want, conditions on this type of behavior. So the main advantage that we use for Gaussian processes, instead of just being able to make a computer do this instead of a gazillion grad students, is we can also incorporate different uncertainties at different pressures. So near low pressures, we're in the crust of the neutron star, and we think we understand that physics better. So the equation of state is probably better constrained there. So I'm going to actually draw what our processes look like. That was just an example. If we have log p, and this is phi, typically what happens, and you'll see some actual examples there, is phi starts here, and it happens to be around a numerical value of 6, whatever that means. and then it goes down like this. When it goes down, this in this auxiliary variable means the equation of state is stiffening, so it's getting harder. So if that's the mean, we end up typically with uncertainties that are small here. So they track like this around the mean, and then they get big at higher pressures. So if this is what sort of what your covariance kernel looks like, it means that the trial functions that you'll actually generate will sort of wiggle and stay close here, but then they can do big stuff over here, like that. So naturally then, the types of functions that I generate will track my physical knowledge about the uncertainty in the equation of state. At low pressures, I know it pretty well, so they stay within a certain region. And then at high pressures, I can try anything I want, right? It'll just do a bunch of wiggly things. In fact, our new paper, which we're almost gonna get on archive, extends this to both look at sort of long perturbation modes, those things that change very slowly, and then things that can wiggle a lot. So these things could have, you know, a bunch of spikes like that. The manifestation of one of these spikes is something like the sound speed changes rapidly. That sounds a lot like a phase transition. So you can try things that have no phase transitions that are very long and smooth, or things that have a phase transition, you know, every day. You know, they flip back and forth all the time. So this is what a Gaussian process does. There are technical details behind how you construct this kernel, but the way we do it is to include the information from theory that we know low pressure physics well. We really want to try anything that's possible at high pressure, and then we're going to compare that to the data. Okay, so let's look at some more examples of this. You go off? Okay. So when we train on tabular equation of state, you just give me any tabular, let's say Will goes home and he finds one in this mailbox. He comes back and he says, here's a new equation of states. Please incorporate in your analysis. We take arbitrarily sampled, it doesn't have to be regularly sampled equation of state, and we can transform it into our auxiliary variable space self-consistently. We do this with a Gaussian process, unsurprisingly, but basically you take sparsely or regularly sampled data, you can map it into an irregularly sampled process. So I'm showing here the inferred equation of state, also the derivative of the inferred equation of state, and you can see it doesn't match perfectly, but the important point is when I put it into this auxiliary space, I also get an estimate of how bad I'm doing, right? So my Gaussian process gives me this uncertainty band for free. So I can incorporate that when I say, this is what Will's equation of state says in this auxiliary variable. I really say, you know, Will's equation of state says this to some uncertainty because he didn't give me an infinite number of points in his tabular equation of state. So I do this for a bunch of different tabular equation of states. I get some sort of idea of the general trend. These things typically line up at low density. So, you know, over here they'll pile up, over here they'll differ, and then I generate one big equation of state generating process that emulates this type of behavior. So on the left, in the blue, is what I've tried to illustrate there, and you can see things typically stitch on. They're similar at low densities, but at high densities, it's like a horse's tail or a whip or something, and it's spreading out. You're trying a bunch of different type of behavior. The way this is actually controlled, ask me about this later for technical details, it's through the hyperparameters of the Gaussian process. So I have things like the length scale and the overall correlation amplitude. You see there's some degeneracy. And these will produce things that typically look like your equation of state. So what I trained it on was the red here, and then what's coming out of this sort of ad hoc run is the gray. We've done much more careful jobs of this in our actual paper. You can then change the hyperparameters and get more and bigger wiggles, right? So here at the high density range, I'm really saying, I really don't know what it is. So compared to that, there's a lot more freedom there. And then in fact, you can do things like not have any tabulated data and really just look at the super high density stuff and let it do whatever you want. And you can see where you sort of pick that break can translate very naturally to where there are a bunch of phase transitions and things like that. So based on how you construct this Gaussian process, you can bake in whatever type of physics you want, and then you can just test it against the data, and that's what we've done. Yes?
So is sigma of the Gaussian process tunable? So?
Yep. Okay. So what we put in is all these equations of states that we map. So we take tabulated equation of state, and we get these guys, right? Then we do that for, right now in the current paper, 50. We do 50 different equations of state, and that's just because we did a survey of the literature and thought that was sufficient. Then based on those 50, we pick a single sigma So x-axis here and a length scale here. There are actually a few other hyperparameters too. And based on that, we condition on the tabulated equations of state. And that gives us this sort of behavior, sort of a posteriori, like the condition, the blue things are what you would generate. So if you picked a slightly different sigma or a slightly different L, you get different, slightly different types of L or of blue curves there. And that's in fact what I'm doing here versus here. I'm choosing different combinations of L's and sigma. What we do in our paper, instead of picking our previous paper, we picked one L and one sigma. In the current paper, which is not yet on archive, we basically randomly choose a bunch of different L's and sigmas and include them all together. So we actually have multiple Gaussian processes that are generating multiple different types of functional behavior. So we get, you know, very rapid oscillations, very big oscillations, small, long scale. We just try everything. Okay. So this is the type of stuff that we get. On the right here, this is what we call our informed prior process. So the red things are what we've trained upon. And the blue things underneath are an example of the, I think it's something like 500 draws from our prior. And you can see they generally do follow pretty closely what's in the literature. On the left here is what we call our agnostic. And that's the one I'm going to focus on. In the informed case, this is actually such a tight prior that we basically get the prior back. So we get our assumptions that we put in out at the back of the analysis. Interesting, but not the main focus of what I'm going to talk about. The agnostic one, we literally are just trying everything. So again, you can see they're sort of centered on where the red training curves are, but they definitely have much broader behavior than that. So I'm trying what I would argue is a superset of the functional behavior that theorists have predicted in the literature. The other thing I've noted here is pulsar. So if you know that massive pulsars exist, basically you know that the pressure has to get really high at high densities. So there are some curves here that are drawn from our prior, so realizations of a Gaussian process that we throw out at the beginning, because these things don't support two solar mass neutron stars. So you downweight these things because you know that pulsars exist, and there are better ways to do it. Talk to Cole and Cecilia. We're working on those as well, but it basically will push you up at high pressure. You can still have a bunch of stuff that comes over here and then shoots up, though. Okay.
Question on the right side, when you have informed, do you have a few equation states?
That shoot away from it? Yeah.
Why are the blue ones not tracking that?
So what's happening here is this subset, it's basically like one family of equation of state that contain quark matter. And this thing is when it's doing a strong transition to quark matter. The relevant density range for 0817 is sort of down here. So we are well below where they've modeled that in the equation of state. The real reason why we don't pick up on this that well is in fact because this is a very sharp corner. And it makes it difficult for our Gaussian process to learn that from the tabulated equation of state when you combine the fact that this is like one family out of like five or six that we use for quark, and most of them don't display that. The average behavior that our process produces doesn't do such thing. I will show that, at least in the agnostic case, there are very sharp turns that come out of the process.
And are you basically giving, in the right-hand case, equal weight to all of the tabulated equations that you have?
No, we have, it is not a unique prescription, but we have a prescription. We take, like, let's say, you know, Cole, you produce 50 equations of state because you're very prolific and you write a lot. But, you know, let's say Will only produces two because he's got a really old computer and it takes a long time for tech to compile. What we do first is we take all of your equations of state, combine them together, and we take all of Will's and combine them together. And then we take the processes representing your typical behavior and his typical behavior and combine them. So each tabulated equation of state from the literature gets a different weight, but we've tried to like weight the types of behavior equally well.
But if Will is using outstandingly precise top order nuclear physics and I'm writing for mental institution, those get the same weight.
Correct. And that would muck me up here. And I argue it does not muck me up here because I'm not really constrained by the red curves here. I'm literally just trying everything. Like I use the red curves to say like on average maybe here, but it goes wiggly squiggly all around. Okay, so jumping right ahead to results. Again, I'm not gonna focus on the informed very much because if you look at the red and the blue curves here, you'll see that they're basically the same curve. And that's that telling me is with the informed prior, I'm getting my prior assumptions back. So the data's not strong enough to tell me something different, which again, if I believe that I have done a good job of representing theoretical knowledge, this could be super interesting. But if I just, you know, say maybe I didn't read the papers carefully enough, this is the one that I would, you know, bet my house on. So the main thing that you find is that 0817 favors softer equations of state. This is not particularly surprising. Many people have pointed this out in the literature. So, you know, we agree with that. And this is generally a trend just to lower pressures at every density. That's what we mean by softer equation of state. You can see that we still have pretty big uncertainties, like the up and down of this purple is pretty big, but it's just shifted systematically to lower things.
Sorry, I think I got confused. So far, I thought you were introducing a method by which you would just interpolate between the equation states and producer equation states. Now you're telling us something about the result when comparing with GW17 or A17. So you, what's not hitting here, what's not said here is you use those, you went through the pipeline, all this, okay?
So, exactly, anticipated me. I'm glad I planted that question. What we actually compare to in the data is the masses and the tidal deformabilities put into the waveforms that are then compared with what we observed at the sites. So here I have lambda 1, the tidal deformability of the more massive companion, and that companion's mass. The prior, again, this is just sort of a smoothed over thing, but each equation of state that we generate, and we generate something like 10 million at least, is just one line here. And then we average over, so they say this is the typical behavior, but what we actually compare is we take each equation of state, and we compare it for a bunch of different masses, see how much this could represent the data or match the data, that each equation of state gets an overall weight. And then that's what we use to assign things like this. Okay. So we do that actually in the four-dimensional space, so lambda 1, lambda 2, m1, m2. Those are the things that we that imprint on our waveform, so that's what we use. The typical trend here is that our priors, you know, our analysis doesn't really change the inference over what the masses were. So looking at the green here versus the purple, the green is just a flat prior on masses that's independent of what the lambda is, just what the data says. Compared to the purple, they don't shift that much. So the blue is what we put in from our R prior, what we were doing. So when you take the light blue multiplied by the green, you get something like the purple. That's all we're saying there. So the masses don't really change that much, but a posteriori, our inference of what the tidal deformabilities is does change from our prior. It prefers much smaller tidal deformabilities, softer equation state, and that's how we're getting the information displayed there. And again, you can see over here in the lambda 1, lambda 2, typically the curves will look something like this in this space. And when you apply the gravitation wave data, it takes this big, fat, light blue prior and sort of squishes it down to this posterior. So sort of down in the corner, and it's, you know, a little hard to see exactly what's going on there. But this plot has appeared in many different papers in the literature, and they all look like that. So it prefers small lambdas, soft equations of state. This is for the components of 0817. I sort of don't care about those. Like, cool, it's great. It's my favorite signal that we've detected so far, but like, I'm not particularly wedded to it. If you then go on and start looking at things canonical neutron star properties, we also, this is in upcoming work, the paper that I said is gonna come up soon. What I'm plotting here is the baryonic mass, so the number of protons that I had to throw into this thing, compared to the radius of a 1.4 and the tidal deformability of a 1.4. What you can actually see is that, you know, you prefer larger baryonic masses for 1.4. So what that means is more gravitational binding energy, so a more compact thing, it's collapsed in more itself, and also smaller radii and smaller tidal deformabilities. I show these just to point out that when you take data from 0817, you can apply it to any neutron star that you want in any other system. So you can get canonical numbers like this. You can also get canonical numbers for things like the maximum mass that will be supported by the neutron star. Again, because it favors soft things a posteriori, the maximum mass will tend to go down. I will point out that the numbers from our paper to come, depending on which prior you assume, let's look at the agnostic one, are like 2.3. And the new really big neutron star is 2.14 plus or minus 1, something like that. So we're pretty close. Yeah.
So why did you choose your prior to disfavor lambda equals 0?
So, right. What we have assumed in this analysis is that both objects are neutron stars and that they share a common equation of states. In that case, you have no support at lambda equals 0. I'm not going to show it, but we do have results where you say, well, what if one of them is a black hole? What if both of them are a black hole, and can you rule that out compared to this? And the answer is like, sort of, but also you saw really bright electromagnetic things, so that tells us at least one neutron star was there.
Okay.
But that is why there's no firework. Yes.
You might know Simon has 120,000. Do we still imagine we have gone up a bit?
Yeah, so the
2.3.
Yeah, so there was one that the most for a long time the most massive neutron star that had been observed was 2.01 solar masses plus or minus 0.03. There's a brand new paper out that found one that they say 2.14. And we're saying that these are just the biggest ones that anyone has seen. And according to our equations of states that we tried, the biggest one that there ever could be is 2.3.
I think I should increase the masses really significantly. 2 to 2.3.
There are
reasons why the maximum mass is 2.
Well, I mean, but we've seen one that's probably bigger than 2.
2.0.
Right. So I agree. But again, this is the agnostic thing. This is where I'm trying like any crazy equation to stay. So this would include things that are basically causal sound speeds, or almost causal sound speeds from very early on. So it is a very loose prior, and that's why you don't have a particularly tight bound here. Maybe we can talk more about this after the talk. Right. So just to stress this a little more, you can actually just get full processes, not just for the equation of state, but for things like mass radius relations, mass lambda relations. Again, lambdas like to be smaller at all masses, radiuses like to be smaller at all masses. This is sort of a horizontal band because it turns out in the relevant mass range, most equations of state just produce like one radius. Or an almost constant radius. But you can get these types of things. In addition to just these shaded bands, what you can also get is the correlation, again, between what the radius here is at a 1 solar mass star and a 4 solar, or you know, 1.8 solar mass star. You get the full covariance matrix comes out of our analysis. It's just really hard to plot that in two dimensions. Again, you can get things like the moment of inertia, which I've been told pulsar measurements might be able to get at. You can even do things like what is the maximum spin frequency of a pulsar. So you can estimate this. There are some things that are not published as universal relations, but like sort of are universal relations in terms of compactness. They're accurate to about 10%. And you can start looking at what this prediction is compared to, say, the fastest known pulsar. And you would basically say, okay, maybe I'm gonna start to rule out things that are less than a solar mass, but most neutron stars are bigger than a solar mass anyway. So yes.
This is for any star, right?
Yep. You tell me a star, I'll tell you what I believe about it.
But if I change the star mass, the expected radius to change, right? Why is it flat? Why is it...
Because for most equations of state, the mass radius curve, I've plotted this the other way that most people do. Typically, radius versus mass curves are plotted like this, and a lot of them look like this. So it's just within this mass range, it looks flat. So the fact that I've plotted it within this mass range, almost all the equations of state are these horizontal lines here, which is just a quirk of neutron stars.
But in your the equations of state that you generate are not necessarily informed by those.
Okay.
So I'm wondering about the lower bound of the radius.
Yeah.
I mean, no one has written down that equation of state that will go to a much lower radius without doing something funny. So why are you not allowing for?
So there's some spread, and these lines here, the outermost lines, there's a 90% confidence region. So at each mass, so there are a bunch of different equation of states in our prior that live below this, quite below. And it's just that those are not, there aren't many of them in the prior because of the way we've constructed, they do exist. I will say that, you know, not all mass radius curves look like this. A lot of them do much more funny things, like they have multiple stable branches. And in fact, we've gone and we've looked for that behavior exactly. So if you condition both your prior and your posterior on the number of stable branches, like whether there are hybrid stars, you can start to say, you know, if there's only a single neutron star branch, this is what I look like. And over here, if we have multiple stable branches, there are hybrid stars, this is what I look like. And you can do model selection between them. So I can say, what is the probability, the marginal probability of this case versus this case? And we actually come out with a very slight preference for there being hybrid branches in the neutron star.
So was that going after before? Is it, if you kind of are saying that the lower radius that you're allowing is supported by 8.9 kilometers,
right.
That's just all prior. And
principle, there is nothing, because you didn't see any prior modulation of the waveform, so this is just all prior.
Yeah, so, right. If you look here, well, you guys can't see it, but I can. There, what he's pointing out is that the blue curve actually doesn't touch zero. This is what we've talked about before. So the lower bound here is entirely driven by the prior that I'm setting. If I don't have the plots here, but if you looked at the informed case, this thing, right, that prior bound would be way up here. And indeed, we get very different results for the informed case and the agnostic because that lower prior bound is what's driving us. So I would argue that we have about as general functional freedom as is realistically allowable or like computation trackable right now. It does exclude this little bit, and there's going to be some sort of roll off. And that is indeed very much determining this part of the behavior here. So the lower bound here, you're right, is prior dominated. And one of the things that we've stressed multiply is because that is the case, you have to know very carefully what your prior is and like the correlation length scales that you put in. So if someone, yeah.
I guess I'm trying to get it, maybe you're saying it, and I'm being very slow here. So what is the type of double-linear equation of state that people have written before? Don't you have this method, this Gaussian process, can scan a much broader set?
Right.
So can I interpret this law that's saying there is no way that someone could write an equation of state subject to the natural conditions you put in that would allow me to say, oh, there is a possibility of 7.5 kilohertz?
So I would not go quite so far. I would say that it is unlikely, like of in the space of possible equations of state, the ones that produce neutron stars that are this compact are relatively rare. That does not mean that there is no such theory that could produce such a thing. And in fact, you know, I think that there are some that go down to maybe even like 6 or 7 kilometers in our priors, but they're just dominated by, it's way easier to make things that end up around like 1.4. Okay. Yeah?
So you're saying you could have like a 1.4 solar mass object in 6 kilometers with an equation of state that could also sustain 2 solar masses.
So don't quote me on those numbers exactly, but I think there are draws in our prior, like let's talk afterwards and I'll try to get you an exact number. But for one, like R1.4, somewhere between like 7 and 8, I think there are a handful. And again, we had to draw like tens of millions of prior draws to get just a handful of them. So they're very, very rare in our prior process, but there are things in it. And we don't actually require that they go up to 2, we require that they go up to 1.93. It's the 2 sigma lower bounds of, you know, the previous pulse. So there are, and that like that behavior is going to depend very crucially on exactly how you impose the pulsar data, as you know well. So I mean, let's talk afterwards and get the exact numbers. But yes, like these things are rare, but they are supported. Because you can go causal and then get really sick. Okay. So moving on, just to show you. This is with the agnostic case. We're starting to see some sort of preference for multiple stable branches, which would mean like phase transitions possibly. Let me finish this slide and then. But the other thing is up here, you'll see that I've listed different types of composition. If you believe our informed prior is reasonable, we broke it into different compositions. So whether it was trained on quark or just hadronic equations of state, you can then do model selection between them. And we again see roughly a factor of 2 preference for quark equations of state. These are also, though, the problematic ones that were pointed out that have like the phase transitions that we're not modeling that great. So take that with a grain of salt. But we're starting to see marginal evidence because we want to be really soft here from gravitational waves and really stiff up there from pulsars.
Yeah, so I was going to ask if there you're considering the data from GWs by TUAs and team, because I understand the central density in those stars would actually not reach the densities where this phase transition would happen to lead to the hybrid stars.
Right, so what we infer about the central densities of the objects, it's like self-consistent in our analysis. We quote it, I have it probably buried in one of the extra slides. They live something here at like 2 nuclear density. So they're sort of on this part of the branch, which if you look, here's sort of a different representation. Each one of these fuzzy lines you can see is one equation of state, and I'm overlapping them. So if they live here, there's a chance that they already had some sort of new particle in their core, if you believe it's a phase transition, and if you know. So there are a lot of ifs there, and the evidence is still pretty marginal. But if all that holds together, it could be that there were hyperons or whatever in the core of the objects before they collided. which I think is cool, but again, this number is 2. So like you don't go to the track and bet your life savings on that. We're not gonna go to Stockholm anytime soon. But okay, so this is basically all I have to say about that. Just to remind you, my goals were to self-consistently include equation of state models, so I can do that by conditioning. I then have a huge amount of degrees of freedom, and I claim that my priors are natural and sort of transparent, because what I'm really setting is how quickly these things can wiggle and over what length scales. Okay, so come talk to me if any of this is interesting you after this talk. The next thing I'm gonna talk about are fluid instabilities in neutron stars. So to preface this with a little bit of history for what people here might work on, these types of fluid instabilities have never actually been seen in like full hydro GR simulations. It's because the relevant length scales are too small to be resolved right now, just due to the computational limitations. There have been a bunch of analytic, sort of quasi-analytic studies. All of those have found such an instability exists, but they disagree on exactly the growth rate and the saturation mechanism. So there's a lot of theoretical uncertainty about some of these types of things. I'll show you how we bake that into our analysis and what we're able to say at the end of the day. So a lightning review. We're talking about multimode interactions. So we specifically analyzed the problem using a Galerkin decomposition of the full PDE into linear eigenmodes. They are then coupled through these nonlinear hydrocouplings, and you get things that look like Feynman diagrams. So if you excite the linear tide, it can then couple into what we call daughter modes. If these guys get big enough, then they can couple into granddaughter modes and make these whole cascades. The coupling strengths, these things are determined by the mode shapes, which are in turn determined by the equation of state. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. But the papers that have investigated this have looked at that, and they find that this is generically something that probably happens. But again, the growth rate and exactly where it saturates is pretty uncertain. Specifically, I'm going to talk about nonlinear stuff just to run through the linear stuff. We basically don't think that linear instabilities or resonant instabilities of the nonlinear kind will matter, because the gravitational waves are driving the inspiral so quickly, we don't spend enough time on resonance to dump energy into these linear or nonlinear resonant excitations. So I'll just flip by this. Basically, if you're at high frequencies, you're evolving really fast, but you have a strong coupling. So you might be able to push hard enough in the short time that you have. If you're at low frequencies, you have a weaker coupling, you can't push as hard, but you spend more time there. It turns out, if you crank through the numbers, it is the high frequency stuff that dominates. So the last few, like the F modes or the very low order G modes, that would affect your signal the most. However, these things are still crazy small and going to be really difficult to measure. So I'm not going to focus on them for the rest of the talk. I am going to talk about these PG secular instabilities. That's what I was alluding to previously. This is a nonlinear instability between the tidal bulge, so the quasi-static deformation, the equilibrium tide, high pressure or a high frequency P mode and a low frequency G mode. Again, every study that's looked at this has found that the instability exists. They just argue about how quickly it grows. So I'm just going to flip through all this text. Please don't try to read it. But this is just to say it's difficult to simulate, and there's arguments in the literature about how big it should be. People have gone back and forth. But because of this, the state of the field, we don't have precise theoretical predictions for it. We instead have built a phenomenological model. So the three things that are really characteristic of this instability is it saturates at some amplitude. It turns on at some frequency. So basically, there's an instability. At some point, you're going to get forcing strong enough to make it unstable. We parameterize that in terms of a gravitation wave frequency, the way we'd see it start turning on. And then n is a scalar or a scaling of how quickly it's going to grow with frequency. So at higher frequencies, when the bodies are closer together, you might have stronger tidal driving. You might get some sort of evolution. So we include these three things in our phenomenological model, and we go off and we look for them. Physically, what's happening is at some point, the instability turns on. And we believe that it grows rapidly. So once it turns on, it acts as an extra energy sink in the orbit. This takes energy out of the orbit in addition to what gravitation waves are radiating, which makes you coalesce a little faster, so you inspire a little faster. That manifests in our signal as a phase shift. So here at 43 hertz, there's basically one curve here. It's blue-green because there's blue and green on top of each other. So before the instability turns on, the waveform with and without this extra feature are on top of each other. You can't tell them apart. But after, at 56, what you can see is that the two curves start to slip. So what's happening is that the one that includes the nonlinear tides is coalescing a little faster. It's evolving a little faster, and that produces this phase shift. And at higher and higher frequencies, the phase shift can build up, and you can possibly get, you know, a few cycles that could be missed if this thing is really, really loud. So physically, this is how it would manifest in our signal, and we go looking for this thing in the actual data.
How does the magnitude of this effect compare to just the usual kind of deformability effect?
Crazy small. So this thing, the numbers that I'm going to quote are in terms of this amplitude parameter, which is really just the precise number of that is a meaningless quantity. But this thing will, you know, contain a very small fraction of the total energy in the system, or even just the binding energy of the star. Like, anyway, let me put it this way. We can sort of detect linear tides, because I use those to look at the equation of state. We did not detect this. So it is a smaller effect. That's the true statement of the doubt. Yeah.
Interesting overlap of the signal with the tides, with an R1 that doesn't have the tides, but has different physical parameters.
Yes. So that's the main source of confusion. In fact, the biggest thing that happens is this thing just, if you have the tides, it evolves faster. It will also evolve faster if the masses are just bigger, right? So you get a big degeneracy between the chirp mass and this thing. And the way that you can break that is because this turns on at a certain frequency, whereas GR doesn't have that scale built in. If that turn on frequency is like way early, then you essentially have this degeneracy throughout your entire observable band and you can't. So here are my posteriors. Focus on the thick black lines here. This is exactly what we were just talking about. The part that's ruled out is sort of the big amplitude, so the right side of this, and the low frequency. So it's loud, and it turned on early, so it can build up a lot. But you can also see that this thing, this little pocket that it's carved out and ruled out, starts to come back a little bit at low frequency. That's because the minimum frequency I considered in my analysis was like 30 hertz. So if it turns on much below 30 hertz, I sort of am not able to see it as easily. So this is the actual data that comes out of the detectors. And the things that jump out to me, at least, is there's a peak in the amplitude, and there's a peak in the frequency. And to me, this looks like, oh my god, I'm starting to measure something. Like, that's really exciting. So maybe we've had, you know, something real. But you also notice that there's sort of this flattish tail. It's still a little wiggly and looks a little ratty, but it's pretty flat down here at small a's, which means that the ratio of the likelihood ratio between sort of, can't even see my own laser, between the very small a's, so the very quiet things that are basically so small, like this is three orders of magnitude smaller. So these are things that are essentially not there, like you'd never be able to observe it, to the peak is maybe a factor of two. So again, it's a very weak preference. And that is important because, or we quantify this in terms of a Bayes factor. The log Bayes factor is zero, which means that the Bayes factor is one. So basically, the data doesn't tell you whether these things are there or not. It's perfectly happy if you have them there, but then they're just, you know, pretty small. Or if they're not there, again, it's perfectly happy with them just being there compared to everywhere else. Like, it's not that statistically unlikely. The data says that it's, you know, it's equally likely. This number is a little fragile, though. You can make different assumptions and push it around. So what we did is we actually injected things into the data, so fake signals that mimicked like the masses and the parameters that we thought QWA817 had. And we said, you know, just with different noise realizations, different Gaussian noise in the background, how would this affect the statistic? And even with two, we saw one where the Bayes factor was much smaller. Okay, that's good. But we also saw one where it was bigger, significantly bigger, which means that noise alone could do this roughly half the time. So then we did a lot more injections, and we measured that number, and basically it gets down to roughly half the time noise alone would do this. Yeah.
Did you use a specific equation of state for calculating your
QWA? So in the original theoretical studies, yes. And I think the original one used something like four, and there have been a few studies that expanded upon that. In this analysis, we do not assume an equation of state. Okay. But anyway, so the point is that even though these bumps look exciting, it's nothing to write home about. Noise could do it all the time, so you definitely did not detect gravitational waves. To go back to this point, though, you definitely didn't rule them out either. So there have been some claims in the literature that say PG modes definitely don't exist. The data ruled it out. Turns out that that paper was only off by 9 orders of magnitude. So we're right, they're wrong. These things could exist, they don't, but we are excluding some part of the very, very loud stuff, so the theoretical maximum is sort of ruled out there. But there's still a lot of theory space where they could be.
So have you tried just use background and run this thing and compute posterior, et cetera, compute phase factor?
Yeah, so I'm just showing the Bayes factor here. So that's what I did. If I just took no signal at all present in the data, I would get Bayes factors of basically zero because there's no signal there. So what I've done here is I've put in a signal and then said, given different noise realizations, how much would I be confused about whether these things exist or not? And the answer is way more than what I can currently see. So these are both fake. This one's real. So if it was on this, if the blue was on this side, I would really confidently detect it. But it's not. So it's 50% chance that this could be noise by itself. And in fact, when we do this, if you look at the posteriors for this guy looks a lot like this. So just by eye, it's mimicking what we saw in the real data. So at this point, my bet is that this was a noise fluctuation and that the actual PG modes saturate a lower amplitude than that. But we can't actually say that from the data super confident. So the last thing, this gets a little bit to what Will was saying. The amount of energy that were drained in these nonlinear tidal couplings, we can compute that, put a bound on that. It turns out if you take like the 90% confidence region here and you go up to incredibly high frequencies, so towards the end of the end spiral, you get up to maybe 1% of the total energy radiated as gravitational waves. So what that you could argue then that you're making a 1% measurement or a few percent measurement with a single event. Hey, that's not bad. It just turns out that theory predicts these things are really quiet. So we can't constrain that much. Okay. Right, so I'm just gonna end with a survey of dynamical tides, and this will leave plenty of time for more questions. So the Bayes factor is a little bit bigger than zero, but basically the log Bayes factor is zero. So we can't rule it out, but we definitely didn't detect it. One thing I haven't shown here is what I didn't mention. It is shown. If you look at these other curves, the light and dark blue, these are analyses using only one of the detectors. So I can't remember whether light blue is Livingston or dark blue is Livingston. But if you do the single detector analysis, you get similar peaks. And that's why when you do both detectors, which is the dark blue, or the dark black, that's why you see a big peak there. So it does show up. You do see these things in each detector separately. And then when you do the combined analysis, which should be the most powerful thing, that's why it continues to persist there. So that does look like if it was real, you would expect that type of behavior. But again, we quantified the statistics, and this thing happens all the time. You can have fluctuations in both detectors that line up like that roughly half the time. So it could just be due to Gaussian noise. We constrain the amount of energy. It's consistent with a large number of possible saturation scenarios, so definitely not ruled out. But something that we're going to look at in the future, and then if you can get energy scales, you can put things like how big the modes are before they saturate, and you can start to get at possibly some of the astroseismology inside the neutron stars through this angle, which I, again, think is really cool. Okay, so to connect the first part of the talk with the second part of the talk, maybe I can use equation of state inference, because I think I have a fancy machine learning Gaussian processing to do that. Can that help me here? I would argue that for linear or resonant things, it could possibly. Certainly for linear tides, it's because it will predict where the modes are, and then you can have the theory for how those modes will get rung up is pretty well established. People believe it. So if you know the equation of state, the high accuracy, you could predict that well, but the effects are so small, like even smaller than this nonlinear tidal thing I was talking about, that it's probably unimportant. However, right now for the nonlinear, non-resonant stuff, there's enough uncertainty in the actual like saturation mechanics within the neutron star that even if I knew the equation of state perfectly and I knew all the modes, their shapes, their frequencies, everything perfectly, it's still a very difficult calculation to figure out how those things saturate. So knowledge of the equation of state doesn't necessarily mean that I'll be able to predict that thing better, but as we work together to sort of constrain both these things at the same time with phenomenological models, and actually, equation of state tests, we should be able to work together to figure out everything simultaneously. But there's no silver bullet for it right now. Okay, so excuse me. So I'm just going to leave this up here. These are references to the papers that I mostly talked about. This is the one that's coming out soon. Soon is probably about 2 weeks. And also note that I do a bunch of other stuff that I don't have time to talk about today, but if you want to know about any of the things listed there, come find me before tomorrow afternoon. I'd love to chat. So thanks for listening. Happy to take questions.
The question you just taken get to the throw any light on the remnant light, which was completely neutral to light.
Yeah, so the main thing that our analysis could do to say that is use the maximum mass. So this constraint, right? We say that it can't be bigger than 2.3, otherwise it'll collapse to a black hole. The total mass of the system was well above that. But this assumes non-rotating stars, right? So there's a little bit of wiggle room there. And then also you could eject a decent amount of mass, something like, you know, 5% of a solar mass at least. I should mention to do my due diligence, there's a much more comprehensive LIGO-Virgo collaboration paper that looks at exactly that question. And I can give you a reference. And their conclusion is sorta, it's consistent. Like, I think it favors prompt collapse to a black hole, but that is more dominated by the electromagnetic signatures in the gravitation wave data. And the basic idea is if it collapsed promptly, then the whatever neutron star remnant thing couldn't irradiate the surrounding material with too many neutrinos. And that changes the composition of that stuff there, and therefore the color of the kilonova. So based on arguments along those lines, they're able to say that given the colors that we saw, we think it probably collapsed in this time scale. And that time scale is commensurate with, well, it collapsed. So it was a relatively prompt collapse.
Two other events have supposedly been observed, neutron star mergers. Have you checked those?
You mean in gravitational waves?
Yeah.
So right, so there's one, the super event ID is S190425Z. I hate that I know that number as well, as I do. That one is pretty darn confident. We haven't estimated the final like probability of astrophysical origin. We have looked at that internally. I'm not allowed to tell you what the answers are because of collaboration rules. I will say though, that if you think about it, it was lower, so it was further away, that's public knowledge. So it's neutron stars, so the masses can't be that different. So if it's a little bit further away, like maybe a factor of a few, the signal-to-noise ratio must also be a factor of a few lower, means if I got sort of wishy-washy constraints here, I'm going to get even more wishy-washy constraints. So I'm not saying this is true, but perhaps the results will still be dominated by these things.
You know the number by heart.
That's right. Buy me a beer, and then maybe you'll get it up. There have been a couple other claimed detections, low latency alerts. There are two that I know of, and they were retracted. And the reason I know those is because some of the stuff that I do with data quality informed those retractions. So I got woken up in the middle of the night or after dinner or something like that. No. So they were things that we thought were real and low latency. And then there's an automated process that just emails everyone in the world. It says like, oh my God, go look, because it could be really interesting. And then like a few hours later, after people looked at the data, it said like, no, it's not real. So then we maybe stop looking. That happened a couple of times. I'm happy to talk about the specifics of that process as well, if people want to know.
Is it roughly one every four? You guys have retracted so far?
So right now, of the ones that are confident, we have two signals, right? There's 0817, there's 0425. Granted that O3 is much more sensitive than either O1 or O2, but you might think that you have something like a detection rate of one every year, one every 6 months. There's going to be a lot of
stuff. The difference between low latency and then the retraction. So
yeah,
it's roughly 20-25% have been retracted after the second look.
Of neutron stars, yeah. In general, it's much, much lower than that. So the number of... And it's just that the weird noise events that caused the retraction, like we looked at it and we said this is not real. That never happened before these events went out, so the pipelines couldn't have possibly known about it. And it seems to preferentially affect only like the lowest mass systems that they were looking at. So the neutron star side things. If you just look at all of the like the BBH or even some of the bursts, just unmodeled whatever from 01 and 02, the total retraction rate is probably less than 10%, something like that.
But I'm talking about the 03 non-latency.
Just 03, the automatic stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to stand by my statement. I think it's, so it would depend, if you told me like what mass range, then it would change, but overall it's probably less than 10%. And I will say we were shooting for a 10% contamination fraction. So we're not too far off, and the statistics aren't hundreds. But yeah, anyway, if you do subscribe to these things and you get an alert in the middle of the night, you know, take it with a grain of salt. There are all these numbers that say like P astro of 99%. Those have also been known to change for technical reasons. Anyway, so if you point a telescope, you know, maybe point a telescope because that'd be cool. But wait until the catalog paper and sort of all the dust settles.
Looks like 8 out of 40 have an edge, no.
8 out of 40. So that's 20% within error bars.
So I have another question about the uncertainty and the amplitude of this PG effect.
Yeah.
So how much of that is sort of theoretical uncertainty just because nonlinear physics is hard and versus like sort of experimental uncertainty because we don't know the equation of state, we don't know the like viscosity.
Yeah, so I'd say it's entirely that nonlinear physics is hard right now, but that's because the uncertainty that we've put in, like I have an upper limit that I kind of believe because I can count the number of modes that are in the star and I can roughly estimate how big each mode, how much energy each mode could have ever before it would scatter into other degrees of freedom. And then if I say they all grow at like the most optimistic rate, then I can estimate something like a total energy dissipation rate. And that sets the upper limit here. In this scale, it's like -6 or -5.5. So this upper end here is reasonably theoretically motivated by just like scaling arguments. But exactly how low it could go, the saturation for theoretical, like, you know, this is completely unknown. So we put like 5 orders of magnitude here, just as a guess. Try to be conservative. The uncertainty here is dominated by the data, but like, trying to pin this down, if you had a really good GRMHD simulation that saw this thing, saw how it grew, and then you knew that it was supposed to be like right here, that would help this analysis by an immense amount. It's just that that is expensive and hard.
Any other questions? If not, this thing's really good.